Get ready to rack to school at your Nordstrom Rack store, because the deals are amazing. Levi's, Adidas, Volcom, and Hurley from only $20. Save on everyone's favorite denim, sneakers, boots, backpacks, and more at Nordstrom Rack. But hurry, get first dibs on new arrivals from just $20 and make it the best school year ever. Great brands, great prices. That's why you rack.
Hi, everybody. I'm so excited to be here with you today. I am Farm Girl, and today, for the very first time, I am bringing you Talk Farm to Me's 5 Live. And this is where we get to ask 5 questions of an awesome farmer. I am just about to invite our good friend, Joe Evans of Evans and Evans Farm, to join us for 5 questions and to learn all about what he does. Joe Evans is a sheep farmer, and he is in Andes, New York. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
It's great to see you. I'm great. I'm glad we did our little test run, because now I know a lot more about Instagram Live. And I'm glad that we made it work. We've got some folks here with us already, and I gave a little intro, and I was just telling everybody that you are already on Talk Farm to Me with a very in-depth interview with you and with Jackie, Mrs. Sheep Farmer, and you can find it wherever you find your podcast, Talk Farm to Me. It's episode 4 of season 1, and lots of great stuff there, but we're going to cover some different things today. And we're going to start out by hearing a little bit from Joe about his farm. And you guys should all follow him on Instagram at Evans and Evans Farm. And you can find me here, obviously, at XOXO Farm Girl, and everything about the podcast at Talk Farm to Me. I should also mention that if you have a question, a burning question, go ahead and type it into the comments there at the bottom. I will see it. And We'll get it over to Joe. All right, Joe, so tell us about Evans and Evans Farm.
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to the first ever edition of 5 Live. That's a real honor.
You're a brave man.
Yeah, I think I am. Can you just tell me, is the sound coming through? Is the visual? Because I have no idea.
I can hear you great. If you guys can hear out there, maybe give a little thumbs up or a heart or something like that, if you can figure out how to do that at the bottom there.
Right. So I am only one half of Evans and Evans Farm. My wife and I started this business in 2008. We had a little hardscrabble 17-acre farm in Putnam County, which is just north of New York City. 2 counties north, just north of Westchester County, which is a more famous county, I suppose. And we started with 4 sheep in 2008. We really didn't have grand ambitions. We had, and we still have, a small business which is involved in the very strange world of Canada goose control, humane Canada goose control, and we use border collies. And the farm started really because we just needed sheep to train our border collies to keep them sharp, and keep them highly obedient, because we do our work in schools and public parks and places where you have to have dogs that can stop 500 yards away and come back. So we started with those 4 sheep, but we thought this was quite good fun. So we bought, I don't know, I think it was 14 more, and then we bought another 20 a couple of years later. And we used other people's land, because our 17 acres were so woefully poor that there's no way you could have fattened sheep. And we decided right from the outset that we wanted to involve ourselves in a field which didn't have a name. Well, it did have a name then. It was one of several silly names like sustainable agriculture or rotational grazing agriculture, or, you know, the worst one, I think, was multi-paddock adaptive livestock grazing agriculture, which some university out west invented that name. But we wanted to just do simple 100% grass-fed, grass-finished farming, using no grain, no funny cake, as we call it in Wales, which is a food made out of God knows what, very good for fattening sheep, but not the healthiest stuff in the world, in my opinion. I might be wrong on that, but certainly not the healthiest stuff as I see it. So grass and forage, that's what these animals were designed to thrive on. So that's what we set out to do. And by the time we got to a fairly sizable number and we had lambs to sell, we were pretty successful. Jackie was a great salesperson, very calm, not pushy, but she was great in farmers markets. And so we built up a fairly decent head of steam. But we felt we needed one world-famous restaurant from New York or the New York environment to help us out effectively and give us an entree and a reputation. And we happened to live relatively close to Blue Hill at Stone Barns, which is Dan Barber's restaurant. That is one of the most world-famous real foodie restaurants. And our lovely daughter has a very close friend who happened to get a job there as the sous pastry chef making desserts. She was very talented. She got us an entree, to the place, and we went down and rather stupidly spent a hideous amount of money for a 17-course meal, which actually turned into about a 30-course meal. And that 30-course meal came with a taste of wine, which of course was a glass of wine for every course. So we were completely slaughtered by the end, and the chef would recognize that they weren't impressed. So we did gave some thought to the matter and the problem, and we decided that using other people's land, and we were farming by this stage about 200 acres, but we didn't control those 200 acres. So as a result of the rather embarrassing, painstaking, and very expensive, because we had to pay for that meal, so we decided we were going to buy a farm. And we hunted around, and we ended up looking at a place called Andes in the western end of the Catskills, a beautiful area. And we bought a 100-acre farm and moved in 2014. And we've been here ever since. And we did carry on working very hard and researching what this 100% grass-fed and grass-finished explanation meant. And what we found is, which is sort of what we knew, but you have to move them every day. You have to move the sheep every day in the growing season. But it's not as simple as that. You have to get the forage at the right height. Can't be too tall, too lignified, too much stem, in other words, because they don't do well on that. They don't fatten well on that. And they find it stressful. And it certainly can't be too short and grazed too recently, because you'll pick up parasites. And also, again, the nutritional value isn't there because you're grazing the bottom of the stems. And even worse, you are eating into the roots and damaging the quality of the plants. So, but in amongst all this experimentation, we got a call from this gentleman that we didn't know, called Andrew Tarlow from Brooklyn, who has 5 restaurants and a really wonderful old-fashioned butcher shop called Marlowe and Daughters. And the restaurants are Marlowe and Sons, Romans, Achilles Heel, and Diner.
Oh, I've been to those restaurants in Brooklyn. They're fantastic.
Right. And he was sort of a pioneer in the local food and quality food sustainably raised in that movement. That was in 2015, and he committed to buy, without so much as a piece of paper or anything else, he committed to buy 4 animals every 2 weeks and throughout the year. And we have been shipping down that amount and more. We're now sending down around anywhere between 120 and 140 animals. Then he buys them whole. We have to have them slaughtered at a USDA facility up here. And down they go, feet off, skin off, and guts out, because you're not allowed to sell animals with the intestines in this country.
We're getting real here.
We are. Sorry about that, but that is farm talk, I suppose.
No, that's great. I think you've already answered one of the questions that's come across from some of our viewers about how you sell your animals. So it's whole animal butchery, and then Andrew Tarlow and his group, they're all using, you know, every single part of the animal that they can.
Exactly. And then we also found that a few restaurants up here were buying the same way. And, you know, chefs that had migrated from the city with tiny little knives were butchering, cutting up our whole animals. So it, and it's created a viable market, and to the extent where we now have, you know, we own the 100 acres, but we rent and borrow in total about 300 acres of all within the little valley in which we live.
That's fantastic. Now, I mean, you confess to another career of humanely removing geese from parks and fields, et cetera, but you also have quite a long career, and so does your wife, from, consider you guys kind of city slickers, real urban dwellers who were working in, you know, big office buildings. And I'm wondering, with everyone who's listening here, I know they're not all farmers, and there are a bunch of city slickers out there who are thinking about how that rat race is going for them. And I'm wondering if you have any advice for, you know, for folks out there, since you were a city slicker and now you're, you know, a real farmer doing farmer talk here with us.
Well, city slickers have to do what city slickers do best, which is to consult Uncle Google and just Google the heck out of whatever it is you want to do. How to raise sheep if you want to raise sheep. And I would say that sheep is an interesting market, because in 1943, there were 40 million sheep in this country, and now we're down to around between five and 6 million.
Why is that?
Because it was essentially a wool business, and wool became very unfashionable once those awful man-made fibers came into being. And if you want plastic shirts, you know, they've got rid of the lovely wool shirts, and to a lesser extent, cotton and linen.
Yeah, there's an impact to every single thing that we do and every single choice. I mean, you just don't realize, if you're not thinking about sheep all the time, you know, what the impact is to the farming industry.
Right. And also the other big factor was in World War II, the GIs, all the overseas forces, particularly in the Pacific Theater, were fed a non-stop diet of what do they call those military meals, ready-made meals type thing, you know, the sort of original processed food almost. And it was supposed to be lamb, but it was rancid mutton from Australia, because of course they didn't have very good refrigerators. Most of those GIs came back to their families and just said, never again, I will never eat lamb in my life again. And even that prejudice, a quite understandable prejudice, moved on to the generation below them. So is it below or above? So there was that prejudice against lamb, but this generation now of foodies really do love lamb. So there is a captive market and a vibrant market there. You just have to learn how to raise sheep. So in answer to your question, I, you know, get mentors, and I don't have a single live mentor, but I have this person, Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, who wrote this incredible book, Defending Beef. She's a vegetarian environmental lawyer, but she is turned into married a rancher, and really gets to understand and gets readers to understand what benefits responsible grazing and well-managed grazing can bring to the soil, to plants, and to the environment.
Great. I will include the names of these books in the notes after our interview here.
Fred Provenza is another genius in this field. He's written a book on how to move sheep, how sheep are moved through the Alps, how they take multiple types of forages to their benefit. And the latest, a really important book, which, you know, I think this will help explain to people, Sacred Cow by Diana Rogers and Rob Wolf. Rob Wolf is a New York Times journalist, and Diana Wolf is a registered dietitian, and that book is just dynamite.
So thank you for those recommendations. I think that if you guys are out there and you're thinking about being a farmer, that is definitely a place to start. I think you've already garnered some interest from our followers here about whether they can buy direct from your farm or not.
They can. We actually do slaughter animals at a USDA facility for ourselves. We have them put into cuts, which are the most popular cuts, and we keep them on a freezer. So in a freezer, well, several freezers here actually. So you just need to go to our website or our Instagram account and call us up. It's sort of like by appointment only. We're in such a remote area. It's not as if we could have a farm open all the time. a farm school, I should say.
Okay, so Evans and Evans Farm, you want to make sure you follow them, and you can reach out to them on DM. On the bookends of your experience as a farmer, I'm curious to understand, you know, sort of what's the best part of farming and what's the worst? Help me out with those bookends.
The best part is most definitely, and the type of farming we do, is cool summer days, lovely autumn days, where the grass is 12 inches high in the paddock you're going into and 4 inches high in the paddock they're coming out of. And you move them and you just look at their full rumens, and they're chewing the cud and they are happy, content animals. That is bliss to a grass, 100% grass-fed and finished farmer. The downside of farming is, there's one of these cliched phrases which livestock farmers have, but it has too large an element of truth, which is where there's livestock, there's dead stock. Dealing with death, we had our first animal killed by a coyote today.
Oh, no.
Because somebody in a field, which we haven't used because it's at the top end of the farm and we've had deep snow for quite a while, somebody opened a gate, left it open, and we found the tracks. We took the track this morning from where the animal had been killed and hasn't finished eating it by any stretch of the imagination, because we disturbed that. So that's the hard side. That's the hard part of it, is dealing with that.
That is sad. Gosh. And it's always shocking too, right? When you can trace kind of what happened and to see if it was preventable or not. But there is wildlife out there, and I'm sure they're keeping an eye on you.
They certainly are. I'm sorry, that's down to 10% now. So Jackie is going to have to bring this in. So unless
Everybody out there, if you're following right now, start thinking about your questions. We've got a few other questions here to get through. And again, you can make sure that you're keeping in touch with Joe on through his Instagram account. He's got a great accent, and that doesn't come through on over Instagram, but for sure he's very witty, and I enjoy the heck out of following what he and Mrs. Sheep Farmer are doing. So that's your commercial break. All right. So gosh, wow, best and worst. That's a lot. I'm curious, especially now there's sort of a transition with our federal government, and there's been a lot of talk about farming on the government stage and what farmers really want from government or what they don't want. And I'm wondering if there is a way, and this is a question from one of our followers, and she submitted it beforehand, which is a great way to, think about your questions and get them to me before we get started, so we can really, get these questions in there. But like, how can the government be more supportive of farmers and of the kind of work that you're doing when you're talking about regenerative agriculture?
That's a very difficult question, and I'm not really sure how to answer it, other than the government has a sort of undeclared agricultural policy, which is a disaster, because it flows very rapidly or floods into the health arena, because the government has supported or promoted since the 60s an incredibly unhealthy food system that's based upon fructose corn syrup, processed food, ready-made meals, very cheap food. So I would say just get out of that. Stop subsidizing corn and soy and those massive monoculture crops that are spread right across the country, because they're a health disaster and they're an agricultural and an environmental disaster. So, and meat in the meantime has been severely vilified and unfairly vilified as being the villain of the piece, but it's not. Sugar is the villain of the piece. That's why we have an epidemic of obesity, early onset diabetes, heart disease, strokes, et cetera, et cetera. So I would say stop subsidizing that farming. Get people to go back to a more environmentally and healthy way of farming, which is not just to have one crop as your sole source, which, by the way, is a disaster very often for the poor people who've fallen into that trap, because everybody vilifies them too, but you know what? They're just trying to earn a living. And to do that, they basically have to not hire any staff because they can't afford the minimum wage. So they then have to spend every penny that they don't have, because they get it all from the banks, on buying massive equipment, which, you know, can harvest these thousands of acres that they very often own of corn and soy. So that would be my primary piece of advice. It would be nice for farmers to be rewarded for environmentally sound practices. New York City goes some way towards doing that up here in the Catskills, because I think it's 80, 90% of New York City's water comes from the Western Catskills here. And so they do their very best to keep the water pristine and clear, because it's not filtered. It's one of the only major cities in America where it's not filtered. So it can be done, but carbon sequestration, we've talked about off this podcast, off this this publication here. What do we call it? I don't know, this Five Live.
Five Live.
It's too early yet to say how could that be done. My fear, if farmers or ranchers were to be rewarded, as happens now, the money would go to the big ones who don't really farm responsibly because they can't afford to. So, you know, it's a slippery slope. So possibly, the statistic I always give, I think I gave it to you last time, is that in 1900, 40% of the people in this country worked on farms, lived or worked on farms. And they spent 40% of their disposable income on food. Now, 2% live and work on farms, and actually it's declining. And that the average percentage of disposable income spent on food is around 17% now. So, but people are very happy to spend money on things which aren't needed. Food is absolutely vital to sustain life.
Yeah, I have heard that a lot. I think that you've touched on some really important things, and I hope everybody's going to give this a little bit of thought when Joe was talking about how, you know, farmers really need to, especially small-scale farmers, have a hard time keeping up, especially when it comes to equipment. A lot of, like, the modernization, and when you're dealing with grain over grass, there's a huge infrastructure investment, and a lot of small farms of all kinds are really going out of business. I'm doing a series coming up, and the first episode will be released next week on the dairy industry. And boy, oh boy, have dairy farmers taken a real hit, especially the smaller ones, from just what you're talking about. Oh, and next week we are going to meet right here on Five Live, dairy farmer from Clark Dairy Farms, Kyle Clark. So Kyle, if you're out there, hey, we'll see you this time next week. Joe, help me out here. I guess I just wonder, when you walk the street and you say the word farmer and ask someone to do word association or whatever it is, I'm curious what your perspective is on misconceptions about farmers, and if you could pick one in particular and change it, what would it be?
I really do not have a clue how to answer that. That's the most difficult question I've been asked, because there are so many views on what a farmer is and what a farmer isn't. And really, the only people who know that are farmers. And as I said, you know, 2% of the population work on farms, so it's probably only 1, maybe 1.5%. But as I mentioned with regard to, people think about big ag. Very often they are just family farms. They've just, you know, been forced to expand. They were blessed with living on and working on really healthy soils. And this country is really blessed with that, as is Russia and Poland too, and to a lesser extent, France and Britain. It's not easy to say, what misconceptions would I like to have addressed, other than farmers aren't out to poison people. They're not out to hurt. They're just doing their best. In my own humble opinion, barking up the wrong tree or driving down the wrong street with the type of farming that they're doing, which I've covered. But, you know, that's not their fault. It's really the fault of the government I hate to, you know, because I'm not an anti-government person, but they made disastrous decisions and followed some very bad science, and they're still doing it because the World Health Organization, I think we mentioned this in the podcast years ago, but they've put out some really, really bad scientific papers and recognize that they're bad and apologize for them, vilifying meat. I would really get people to try and understand farmers aren't bad people, and we're all just trying to produce food in the best way we know.
One of the things that you told me in our last interview was, I'm going to read a quote from of what you said. You said, very, very few people, probably no more than 2 to 3%, really understand the difference between sheep or cattle that are grazed rotationally, which you've talked about today, and don't need grain and don't need corn, which you've also talked about, that do benefit the soil tremendously through depositing manure, etc. And one of the things that I think this is a pretty big question, and I think it's something that people hear about regenerative agriculture and carbon sequestration, and what the heck is that? Where is the carbon? Where are you sequestering it? And just enlighten us on this big issue and your contribution.
So carbon can be sequestered in many forms. Much of it obviously was sequestered eons ago. Dinosaurs were wandering around, huge forests got buried under permafrost. I think the carbon that is CO2 being absorbed from the air, from the atmosphere, by the process of photosynthesis. So that means, in simple terms, that plants, grasses, forbs, legumes, which is a fancy word for vegetables, and trees, they pluck that CO2 from the air and they take it down into their roots and deposit carbon. Now, that's where the interesting stuff happens, and that's where there's just science on it yet. I mean, it's starting, but it's really sort of 10, 15 years old at best, and not enough is into it. But huge, vitally important slice of life down there in the soil underneath the plants. And that's they play an incredibly important part in storing carbon. If you plow those fields, the carbon is released. So we don't plow, we just graze. And the act of grazing the way that we graze, we are told, is tremendously beneficial because it increases the plant density. It increases the number of plants and therefore increases the microbial activity under the soil, which has a very, very positive effect. And because we don't disturb that soil, the carbon stays there. So the argument that some people are making is that we should be rewarded for that, farmers who do that. But I shudder to think how the government would even begin to that. I mean, you can measure carbon. The science is so new that even the people doing it say it's too hard to do yet.
Hopefully we'll be able to dive into that a little bit in maybe in some future deep dive episodes, because it's really fascinating. And I mean, I think there have been a lot of really great comments coming through with a lot of thumbs up, and farmers are the hardest workers out there. I know for sure that you and Jackie work super, super hard at your farm and super impressive with your, how many sheep? 357 yeah. Sheep as of today. We lost one. And so yeah. Such a bummer. But you're also a grass farmer. You're sequestering carbon. You've got cattle and chickens laying some really incredible eggs out there on your farm, which is a beautiful place. I was scrolling through your Instagram yesterday. I did see some folks making some comments, maybe from Wales. And they're is that Welsh? Is that what they're writing to you in?
They are writing to me. Well, I'm legally schizophrenic because I'm half English and half Welsh. In Wales, and taught Welsh subjects from the age of 3.5 to 7 or 6.5 actually in Welsh. So I still speak Welsh, but at a the level of a 6-year-old. So it's really rather
embarrassing
when I go and have adult conversation. Well, I was going to say nearly all my Welsh relatives were or are still sheep farmers, or I should say sheep, cattle, and a few chickens. And
also, well, it's in your blood, I guess.
It is in my blood. And the English side, actually, they dropped out of polite society. They were far more when the Welsh side of my family, and that paid for me to go to an English school from the age of 7 onwards, or 2 English schools. I sound like an Englishman and act like an Englishman, I suppose, but I am Welsh. And the Welsh side of my family lived on actually, my cousin still lives there, a wonderful but very, very hard farm and living on called Cwmcynwal in Carmarthenshire. And my grandfather and grandmother on that farm had 6 kids. But this is a bit personal, but it really does tell the story of farming, and it's still a story which needs to be absorbed today, is that my grandfather was not a very good farmer. And he also drank way too much and had psychological problems. And he basically lost the farm to the bank, couldn't pay loans, and he inherited the farm. So I don't know why he had bank money. And he died at a young age of, people don't talk about what he died of, but he died at a pretty young age. The amazing thing is that next door, my great uncle, Joe Maur, which is big Joe, because fat for those days and tall. Most Welsh people are very short. He farmed in a completely different way. For those people who are interested in, you know, how to earn a living from farming, don't, whatever you do, in my opinion, get into the commodity based market. You don't control the price, you control the product, but it's, when you don't control the price and you don't control who you sell to, you don't really have a business, in my opinion. Obviously, a lot of people have succeeded and will continue to succeed. It's just, I don't think it's a viable option for people coming into the business. And they had milk in those days. They sold milk, but a tiny amount of it. They only had, each farm would have about 12 dairy cows and sheep and a bunch of chickens. And my uncle, Joe Maur, from the farm next door, his sister married the guy who lost the farm. So he had a vested interest, and the two farms were joining. But he learned from a very early age, learned from his mother, who was called on the census. She's actually, her profession is listed as huckster, which is sort of like a dirty word for grubby salesperson, isn't it? A hucksterish person is not good. And then what her son, Uncle Joe Maur, my great uncle, continued to do was to go buy eggs and chickens and butter off local farmers, and they produced their own as well. And he would get into his pony and trap, ride to the nearest village where they had a very sporadic train service. He would take the train armed with all of these eggs, butter, and chickens, and he would go down to the nearest major town, a place called Swansea, and he would sell those at a profit. Through doing that, he earned enough money to buy back the farm that his brother-in-law had bankrupted, and he put my first uncle, Uncle Will, at the age of 17, I think he was, on the farm. It became essentially, but he it's like an indentured service. He saved that farm through selling farm to market. There's got to be a moral there somewhere, hasn't there?
I think so. Huckster's working hard.
That's a good line.
So I just wanted to go back quickly to some of the comments I saw. Is it true that you're a singer? Tell the truth.
I don't. You better ask Jackie. Jackie, can I sing? I don't know. She says yes, but
let's hear a little bit. You can sing in Welsh. It doesn't have to be anything I know.
I'll do a schizophrenic song then, half English, half Welsh for you.
Excellent. Do it.
It's sort of appropriate. When I was young and in my prime, my face would smile any time. Now I'm old and getting grey, my face can't smile but once a day. Here's the Welsh bit. Rhaen yn gath golew, roedd i ddim yn tenor, roedd i ddim yn tew. Dim ac blewyn garw, bys ein piti te hon yn marw.
Bravo! That was beautiful. I loved it. Jackie's right. You're a very good singer. Before we wrap up here, I wanted to ask you one more question, a little on the silly side. What's your go-to, a cookie or a cocktail? Which one?
Cocktail, probably gin and tonic. And there's a really good local gin manufacturer.
Tell me.
Called Isolation Roof Gin. And it's the man is called Jacob Sherry. What's the distiller? My mind has gone blank on the name. Distillery. But if you look for Isolation Proof Gin from Bogor, just over the hill from here, it's incredible stuff.
I'm going to look for it. Stay tuned because I'm going to make a gin and tonic in your honor. Thank you for sharing all of this great information. I hope those of you who are following here today had a great time. Thank you for all the thumbs up and all of the great questions. You'll be able to find this interview and share it with others or review it. You'll find it on IGTV on my account, XOXO Farm Girl, and also on Talk Farm to Me. Don't forget to follow Joe at Evans and Evans Farm. Stay in touch. If you need some lamb, he's the guy to go to. So I'm really grateful for everybody being here. You'll be able to find more of Joe, and you'll get to hear how a lamb is born from Jackie if you go to the Talk Farm to Me podcast on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And we will see you next week at this exact same time, 12 noon on Thursday. We'll be meeting with Kyle Clark of Clark Dairy Farms. And I'm really excited about that. Joe, you are an amazing first guest, and I'm super grateful and really great to see you.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a lot of fun.
I've got prostate cancer, but I really wanted to make it to the big game with my grandson. And here we are. Go, 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 go! Go.
With Erleada, apalutamide, being there is possible. Erleada is a prescription medicine used to treat prostate cancer that has spread to other parts of the body and still responds to a medical or surgical treatment that lowers testosterone. Erleada may cause serious side effects, including heart disease, stroke, or severe skin reactions, which can lead to death, falls, fractures, and seizure. Seek immediate medical attention if you experience symptoms of a stroke or severe rash. Erleada can cause harm to or loss of an unborn baby. Common side effects were fatigue, joint pain, rash, decreased appetite, weight loss, high blood pressure, hot flash, and diarrhea. Ask your doctor if Erleada is right for you. Or tap this ad to visit Erleada.com, CP43926 7V1.